cloudy and 35. In Kankakee, cloudy and 36 with a wind chill of 29. In Macomb right now, it is cloudy and 32 with a wind chill of only 22. In Bloomington, Illinois, cloudy and 35 with a wind chill of 25. In Rantoul at the moment, pardon me, I've lost my place here on the screen. In Springfield, it's cloudy and 34 with a wind chill of 27. In Rantoul, cloudy and 38. And at Willard Airport in Champaign, it is cloudy and 36 with a dew point of 30 and a wind chill of 26. It's 35 degrees at Friends Plaza in Urbana outside of our studios. You're listening to WILL.
Support comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. This Saturday, March 2nd, from 3 to 6 p.m., the Corkscrew will be pouring from a collection of whites, reds, and even pinks for spring, followed from 7 to 9 p.m. by live music in the Bouvon Wine Bar. Details on the Corkscrew's Facebook page.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. I'm Chris Berube. On Tuesday, we spoke to Lynn Sweet, the Washington bureau chief of the Chicago Sun-Times, about the political fallout from the sequester, the $85 billion in automatic cuts that will start taking effect tomorrow if there's no deal cut in Washington tonight. Well, having talked about the political aspects, I thought it would be time to also look at the economic impact of the sequester. How bad is this actually going to be? There's a growing minority in Washington who think that the sequester cuts really aren't that bad. The size of the federal government, they argue, is already too large, and we might as well just pull off the bandage now and make these cuts all at once. Joining us now to talk about the actual economic impact of the sequester is Dr. Elizabeth Powers. She teaches economics at the University of Illinois. So what's your verdict as an economist? Is the sky falling?
I think it's difficult to think that the impact of the cuts is going to be minimal. I think it'll be kind of shocking to many groups that rely on federal funding for their programs. The overall sequester, it's true, it maybe sounds kind of modest. We're going to cut 5% in non-defense programs and 8% in defense programs. But, no cutting's been done to this point, basically. And so all the cuts have to be crammed into the rest of the year's budget. So that means that you're really talking about 9%, more on the magnitude of 9% in non-defense areas and 13% in defense areas. So once these all get placed on all these programs, they're scrambling to reach this level of cuts by the end of their federal fiscal year, I think you're going to see a lot of pretty noticeable changes.
So they say it's going to be 5%, but it's likely going to be closer to 9. Why is that exactly? How does that work?
Well, the federal fiscal year has been going on since October 1st, and it's just been going on under the premise that there wouldn't be the sequester, and so groups they didn't start the federal fiscal year thinking we're going to have to set 5% to 8% of our total federal funding aside, right, that we that's going to disappear. They've been proceeding with the programs as they normally run, and now here it is, the end of February, and looks like, next month they're going to have to start trying to find this 5 and 8% of their total programs. They're going to find it, over the remainder of the fiscal year.
So let's talk about some of those cuts specifically and how they impact Illinois. What do you think are maybe the most significant issues that are going to be coming to the state?
Because it's across the board, it touches a lot of areas. Some areas that people might hear a lot about are education. We're going to lose about $33 million estimated funding for primary and secondary education. There'll be schools that all see cuts in funding, for example, for extra aides and staff in areas with higher need kids. In programs that serve children with disabilities, for example, there's federal funding in those programs, and those types of programs are going to face serious cuts. There are federal grants, for example, for first responders, for training for first responders. Those are going to get cut out. There are federal work study slots, money for work study for college students. Those are going to get cut, maybe around 3,200 fewer lower-income students in Illinois are going to receive federal aid, and about 2,600, it's estimated, won't be getting work-study jobs that help them pay for college. The cuts are going to affect families and people.
Now, a number of economists have raised the issue of specifically entitlement spending as being something that has to be addressed in the next couple of years. And some people who are, I mean, I don't think there are any sequester advocates necessarily, but there are some people who've kind of quietly said, well, you know, cuts like this may have to happen eventually anyway, so why not rip off the bandage? As an economist, why do you think it's bad, or is it okay to rip off the bandage right now?
I have issues with both the magnitude and the timing. We're pretty fragile here. The recovery has been very frustrating. It's been very slow. Conservative estimates of the impact of the sequester is, you know, it's going to take 0.5% off GDP growth for the year. That's a serious blow to growth. So I question the timing of this, you know, doing this when the economy is in a pretty fragile condition. So the sequester reaches to 2021. So, you know, if and in fact the cuts, they kind of mount over time. If we stick with the sequester, we're really kind of embarking on an unprecedented experiment in shrinking government consumption. And a lot of people aren't aware of this, I think, because there's so much talk about, you know, how large the government is and this kind of stuff. The federal government spending, it's about a quarter of GDP at this point. Historically, over the past 40 years, it's been at around 21%. So, you know, we're not really that far away from kind of our average level. There are a number of programs that are under special rules, and they're exempt, basically, from the sequester. So, you know, you hear people talk about the Social Security system perhaps being a driver of budget deficits, but Social Security benefits are entirely exempt from the sequester, for example. Welfare programs and refundable tax credits are exempt. The Medicare sequester can't exceed more than 2%, so it's under special rule, too. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, the kind of the bugaboos that people always point to as the programs that might be the problem drivers of long-term budget deficits, you know, the sequester doesn't touch them, many of them. The real long-term driver of budget deficits that I think we should be really concerned about are medical costs, right, Medicare and Medicaid, which are both exempt from the sequester. You know, there to control those costs, you know, we've got healthcare reform coming along, and, you know, hopefully we will arrive at really long-term systemic approaches to containing those costs, right? Just saying you're going to cut those types of programs, that you have targets for growth for those types of programs, you know, we've demonstrated over time that as a policy matter, we've had very little control over the growth of healthcare costs. You know, there's very little we've deliberately done where we can show that we contained healthcare costs. That's a big driver of deficits. That's a big problem. It's a complex policy area. And again, you know, just saying you're going to cut stuff isn't likely to be a really successful approach.
Professor Elizabeth Powers, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Elizabeth Powers teaches economics at the University of Illinois. To read all of our sequester coverage online, visit us at will.illinois.edu. You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine on WILL.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe serves breakfast and lunch from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday. Daily menus are available online at bevercafe.illinois.edu. Bevere offers Wi-Fi and is staffed and managed by students. Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 28th of February, 2013. It's the birthday of the novelist Colin McCann, born in Dublin, 1965. His book, Let the Great World Spin, came out in 2009. Grew up in suburban Dublin, middle class, house full of books, majored in journalism, came to the United States at 21, wanted to write a novel. He hopped on a 15-speed Schwinn and rode it around the country 12,000 miles through 40 states, collecting stories all along the way. Colin McCann, who said he's had a happy life, so it doesn't make for an interesting story, he said, for me, the logical conclusion is that I have to write about outside my life. So he said every time he writes a book, I take a brand new 3-year crash course in that which I want to know. To research one novel, he lived with homeless people in subway tunnels. For another, he went to Russia. For one, he looked at maps in the New York Public Library, then went off to Eastern Europe to wander through the gypsy camps. His epic, Let the Great World Spin, set in the 1970s, weaving the stories of a dozen New York protagonists, including prostitutes, a young radical Irish monk, a Park Avenue mother in mourning for her son killed in Vietnam. A story that begins with the image of the tightrope walker high in the air, walking the wire between the World Trade Towers. To get the voice of his protagonist, Tilly, a 38-year-old grandmother, longtime prostitute, McCann did a lot of research. He tried talking with women on the street. He shadowed police detectives around the Bronx, looked through rap sheets, trying to figure out which crime she might have committed, read the memoir of a pimp. He was trying to get the tone of her voice. And then one night, a line came floating to him, which went, "The skinniest dog I ever seen is the one on the side of the Greyhound buses." And he recognized that as the voice that he was trying to channel. He wrote all night, he said, and wound up with 6 pages, a monologue by Tilly, in which she said, "They didn't let me go to Corrigan's funeral. I would have walked the bakery line to get there. They put me back in the pen instead. I weren't crying. I laid straight out on the bench with my hand over my eyes. I saw my rap sheet. It's yellow with 54 entries, typed up, not so neat. You see your life with carbon copies kept in a file, Hunts Point, Lex and 49th, West Side Highway, all the way back to Cleveland." Colin McCann said, "I think a good novel can be a doorstep to despair. I also think the real bravery comes with those who prepare to go through that door and look at the world in all its grime and torment and still find something of value, no matter how small." Here's a poem for today by Joyce Sutphen, entitled Breakfast. "My father taught me how to eat breakfast those mornings when it was my turn to help him milk the cows. I loved rising up from the dark